The History Lesson by Jeanette C. Armstrong. This is a last-minute change from your order of service. Out of the belly of Christopher's ship, a mob bursts, running in all directions, pulling furs off animals, shooting buffalo, shooting each other left and right. Father, meanwhile, waves his makeshift wand, forgives saucer-eyed Indians. Red-coated knights gallop across the prairie to get their men and to build a new world. Pioneers and traders bring gifts, smallpox, seagrams, and Rice Krispies. Civilization has reached the promised land. Between the snap-crackle-pop of smokestacks and multicolored rivers swelling with flower-powered Z are farmers sowing skulls and bones and miners pulling from gaping holes green paper faces of smiling English lady, the colossi in which they trust. While burying, breathing forests and fields beneath concrete and steel, stand shaking fists waiting to mutilate whole civilizations, 10 generations at a blow. Somewhere among the remains of skinless animals is the termination to a long journey and unholy search for the power glimpsed in a garden, forever closed, forever lost.
That's a powerful poem. I need to stop and take a breath before I start the sermon. Our theme for September is promise. And as I try to convey in the children's story, we often think of broken promises causing pain and damage to the person or the people to whom the promise was made. But we don't have to look far to see the damage that a broken promise makes to the person and the organization who are making the promise. People who purchased one of 11 million Volkswagen diesel-powered cars with deceptive emissions controls, they've been hurt. But the company that broke that promise of a clean diesel-powered car is arguably being hurt even more. The engineers who took pride in making some of the best and most innovative cars on the planet are now living in shame. As I reflected on the theme of promise, I was aware that October 1st is celebrated as Treaty Day in Nova Scotia, honoring the treaties between the Mi'kmaq peoples and the British Crown made between 1725 and 1761. And I wondered what effect our breaking of these promises has had on us as a nation. I knew for many reasons that I would need to address the relationship between First Nations and non-Aboriginal peoples in Canada during this service. That picture on the front of the order of service today is symbolic of the treaty process. It's a medal that was produced in 1873 commemorating treaties between Canadian peoples and First Nations. I've learned that such medals are now rare collector's items. I'll explain one of the reasons that I felt compelled to address the state of treaties with First Nations during this month. As many of you know, I was born and raised in Canada, but Janet and I lived in the United States for 17 years before we moved here to Halifax, so that I could serve this congregation. Janet and I seriously considered serving other congregations in the United States, in particular one in Savannah, Georgia. And we spent a long time trying to decide if we would serve in Halifax or Savannah, Georgia. I've told people this story before, but it's important to me. See, being an engineer, I applied my analytical skills to the problem, and I created a matrix of objectives, what I wanted to accomplish, and how well each location met those objectives, assigned points, and totaled up the numbers, and tried to come to a conclusion. And as I did so, the answer kept coming up, Savannah. I mean, Savannah's a beautiful city. And that was even before I had experienced a real Halifax winter. But something in my gut wasn't happy with that result. And I knew that meant I was missing some critical objective in my analysis. There was something that I wanted to achieve that I was not acknowledging. The challenge of ministry in Savannah would have meant facing the race issue that is still so divisive in the U.S. And it slowly dawned on me that I would not feel authentic trying to guide a congregation in that environment. I'd lived in Georgia for 17 years. I had managed a factory where the majority of workers were African American, and yet I still didn't feel qualified to counsel people whose lives had been entirely shaped in that environment. I knew that returning to Canada, I would be faced with issues of racial prejudice that would be just as difficult. But somehow I felt better equipped to serve here. I'd grown up in Canadian culture. I was born and raised in Thunder Bay, Ontario, which is a city with a very high proportion of First Nations peoples. I thought I knew what I'd be dealing with in Canada. And so that the underlying culture and the racial issues in this nation, in the end, became the deciding factor in my decision to come to Halifax. After I got to Halifax, I learned some important things about this congregation and about myself. Regarding the congregation, I learned about our long-standing relationship with the Bear River First Nation, a relationship that spanned years and was quite close. But I've also learned that that relationship has largely faded over time. I learned that there was still a lot of interest in this congregation in building connections with the Mi'kmaq people, and in particular for opportunities to understand their spiritual sources and their understanding of humanity's relationship to our natural environment. I learned that over years, many First Nations peoples had presented services or otherwise been part of Sunday services here in this building. And I believe this included Daniel Paul, whose book I'll be quoting from later this morning. Well, I also learned some things about myself. I learned, after I got to Halifax, that my great-great-grandfather, Murdoch Stewart, was an ordained minister of the Free Church of Scotland, and he emigrated from Scotland to Waikogama on Cape Breton Island as a missionary to the Mi'kmaq peoples. So this service for me marks a new commitment, a renewal of a commitment. I need and believe that this congregation needs, I need personally, and I believe that this congregation needs to build connections with Mi'kmaq peoples for our own benefit, for the benefit of our community, and for the benefit of our country. In the process of preparing for this sermon, I called someone that I knew at the Mi'kmaq Friendship Center, and they provided me with a list of 13 band chiefs in Nova Scotia. And I learned that the Assembly of First Nations Chief for Nova Scotia and Newfoundland is Morley Gugu. And the Grand Chief of Mi'kmaq is Ben Sillyboy. What band do you suppose these two chiefs belong to? Turns out it's the Waikogama Band, or the Waikaba Band, that is centered in Waikogama. I'm struck by the irony, and I feel the irony, and it's quite likely that my great-great-grandfather knew their great-great-grandfather. And this is symbolic of a problem. Although our great-great-grandfathers likely talked to one another, the intervening three generations have not spoken. In 1740, our ancestors needed to talk to the First Nations. Without their support, our ancestors would have perished. In 1940, we could ignore the First Nations, and we did. And when I say we, I recognize I'm speaking for the majority of people here, but that we should be more inclusive and should include the perspective of First Nations, an example of the problem that I am struggling with this. So, one thing about the Mi'kmaq people that is endearing and amazing, and if you saw the article in the paper just a week or so ago, there was an article with a very prominent photograph of Stephen Augustine, who's dean of the Cape Breton University Unimaki College. And he was speaking before an event there, And he used the opportunity to talk about our need to welcome refugees from Syria. That despite the situation that Mi'kmaq people find themselves here in Canada, they are open and they are leading and urging us to welcome refugees into this country. The long and sorry relationship between First Nations people and European immigrants hardly needs to be reviewed here. It was nicely summed up in that poem by another leading First Nations Canadian woman, Jeanette Armstrong. As that poem makes clear, the question of our relationship with First Nations is not just in the past. It shapes who we are as Canadians today. In his book, We Were Not the Savages, author and Order of Canada recipient Daniel Paul describes how the Canadian and Nova Scotian governments in the early 1960s came to authorize Pristine Bay, known as Boat Harbor, on reserve territory as an industrial waste lagoon. This is from the book. Through the offices of the Department of Indian Affairs, the band was approached with a proposal asking for approval to turn this lagoon into a waste reservoir. To encourage band members to decide favorably, public meetings were arranged on the reserve by bureaucrats to disseminate glowing propaganda. At these meetings, members were told that Boat Harbor would not be adversely affected by its use as an industrial waste lagoon. To prove to them that this would be the case, they offered to take the chief to New Brunswick to see firsthand how well a similar system worked. Upon arrival in New Brunswick, provincial and federal bureaucrats transported the chief and counselor to the disposal unit. While there, a provincial engineer took out a small cup and drank what the band officials were told was treated industrial waste effluent. Shockingly, in later investigations by the band's legal counsel, it was discovered that the unit toured was not operational at the time, and in fact didn't come into operation until 2 years later. What the bureaucrat drank that day was water coming from the facility directly from a spring-fed brook. Shortly after the mill using Boat Harbor went into production, the band came face-to-face with the mess that the two senior levels of government had duped them into accepting. Within a short period of time, they found themselves living beside a stinking cesspool that was too toxic for fish to survive, nor could anyone safely swim in the noxious soup. The befouling of this former pristine natural harbor and the stench, noise, and fumes emitted from the pulp mill and the effluent were more unbearable than most of the band members could bear. The suicide rate among band members increased dramatically, and many moved away in despair. In 1986, the band sued for redress, and they ultimately received $35 million in monetary compensation. The Boat Harbor Effluent Lagoon was to be closed in 2006. That was part of the agreement, part of the promise. Today, the government is still promising to close the lagoon. I quote from the Chronicle Herald of April 17th of this year. Closure will happen by January 2020, and the government has set aside $52.3 million for remediation. A trial project for that work is expected to begin this summer, although remediation planning and cleanup are each expected to take several years. Remediation itself could take up to 10 years to complete. Does anyone believe that promise? So I selected this story from among multitudes of stories of broken promises to show the problem is not ancient history. The problem of broken promises continues to this day. The First Nations people of Canada do not see their treaties as technical contracts. They are agreements between honorable nations, and they were meant to protect and honor the future generations of both parties to the treaty. The issue of treaty rights, as we've been reminded in this sanctuary by Billy Lewis, a friend of this congregation, is not a matter for First Nations alone to resolve. A treaty represents two parties, and we in this room are party to those treaties. Honoring the spirit, and not just the letter of those treaties, will make us a better nation, will make us a better people, better environmental, better in our community, in our commitment to diversity, and better in our care for the marginalized people among us, and better in our own self-esteem and our own self-image. For almost 300 years, our government has been trying to resolve the questions of treaty rights by a process of genocide, both mortal genocide and cultural genocide. The goal of governments in Canada for most of our history has been to assimilate First Nations peoples so that their cultures and their way of life would disappear along with their treaty rights. I think it's clear now that First Nations peoples will not allow that to happen, and that the leaders of Canadian society have finally come to realize that such a solution is not only impossible, but it's also immoral. So I'll bring this sermon to a close by reminding you of a new promise that was made on your behalf just last year. In March 29th, 2014, in Edmonton, Alberta, the Canadian Unitarian Council, of which this congregation is a member, and the Unitarian Universalist Ministers of Canada, of which I am a member, made a public and solemn promise to the First Nations people of Canada. The occasion was the ceremony marking the end of the work of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission on the residential school system in Canada. This is the only formal promise that I know of by our CUC and our ministers. And here is what we promised. We, the Canadian Unitarian Council and the Unitarian Universalist Ministers of Canada, commit to the journey of healing and reconciliation between Canadian Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal peoples. Today, we acknowledge and accept our responsibility for truth-telling, healing, and reconciliation. We commit to these specific steps in advance of that journey. To assimilate and promote educational materials for our congregation regarding the history and impact of the Indian residential school system. To create and promote a new program for congregations about racial equity and intercultural competency. To continue to encourage our congregations and their members to learn more about the richness of Aboriginal spirituality and cultures working together to advance the struggles for justice for Aboriginal people. Continuing the quote, not only did non-Aboriginals lose an opportunity to learn from your culture, these understandings were all but eradicated from your children's way of life by the school systems we set up. We must learn from these travesties, as well as from the strength and courage and honesty and resilience and success of those who survived the Indian residential school system. We have asked our congregations across Canada to read this statement, and we want to know that we intend to walk with you. Here ends the quote from our promise. We read this from our pulpit shortly after it was released. And the CUC is working on preparing programs that the church can use, that various congregations can use for the purposes outlined. But the question is, do we want to affirm this as a promise from the Universalist Unitarian Church of Halifax? This is not something we should undertake lightly. I look forward to exploring this promise more deeply with the congregation, and I hope that many of you will see this as a priority for your own spiritual growth. May it be so, and amen.